And I mean, those things meant everything to me as a kid. And it's, I mean, it's way past time. And I mean, I cried. I was so happy. And then I found out that George Takei wasn't happy about it. And I'm like, Uncle George, come on.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, we'll talk with Callie Wright of the Gay Theist Manifesto about what safe spaces really are and why they're important, about celebrating Friendsgiving, and about imposing some retroactive continuity on the next Star Trek movie. When Callie Wright came out as a trans woman in 2013, there weren't a lot of queer voices in the secular movement that focused on issues affecting queer people. She set out to change that. With her partner in crime, Ari Stillman, she now runs the Gay Theist Manifesto podcast and the blog of the same name. She's also co-chair of the American Humanist Association's LGBTQ Humanist Alliance. Callie joins Jen Wilson this week to talk about founding the podcast and its mission to support the LGBTQ community within the secular movement. They discuss Callie's outlook on activism, her goals for the LGBTQ Humanist Alliance, and even a recent controversy in LGBTQ media representation. After we hear from Callie and Jen, we'll also give you a quick sample of the work Callie does educating humanists at conferences. And it is my pleasure to introduce the awesome activist, Callie Wright.
Oh, hi.
Of the Gay Theist Manifesto podcast, and also of the LGBTQ Humanist Alliance, which is an adjunct of the AHA. How you doing?
I am well. A little tired, but I'm good.
Tired? I know you've been traveling a lot to go to cons and speak to people. And
yeah.
Keeping you busy, huh?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about your superhero origin story? How did you come into activism? You've got a vibrant past.
Well, the question of superhero origin story is definitely apropos because, as Pat Robertson has deemed, we all have superpowers, you know, the power to cause earthquakes and hurricanes and floods. And so that's totally good. So I'm a trans woman. I've been out going on 3 years now, and I was really put off by all of the proselytizing that I saw at LGBT events and the sort of, I don't want to say lack of LGBT representation in the atheist and secular community, because we were definitely there, but I didn't see any one person kind of stepping up to be like, okay, this is my niche and this is the conversation that I'm in this movement to have. So I kind of decided, like, okay, well, you know, there's a need there. There's a niche to be filled. So I guess that's what I'm going to do. So I started the Gay Theist Manifesto podcast, partnered with David Smalley from Dogma Debate with his Secular Media Network. He gave us a huge boost at the start and continues to do so now. And so we do the podcast. We release on Thursday mornings. And basically our conversations center around that intersection of LGBTQ and atheist activism and sort of all of the nooks and crannies therein, the different spectrum of queer and trans identities and how the atheist movement interacts with that and how there's some sort of identity corollaries, because it goes deeper than just, you know, the religious right fights against LGBTQ equality. It's, you know, when people leave their religion, sometimes they have an identity crisis that's very similar to when someone's trying to figure out their gender or their sexuality. And I was kind of shocked when I started having conversations with people who had left fundamentalist religion, and they're telling me their stories. And I was kind of floored that their stories kind of sounded like my struggling with my gender identity. And I started to, you know, really think kind of deeply about that. And so I think it makes sense on a couple of different levels. So that's what I do. So, you know, we do the podcast. My co-host is Ari. They're amazing. And then, you know, I try and get in front of as many rooms of people as I can to talk, get invited to speak at conventions and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, so that's me.
Awesome.
Yeah, how long chronologically have you been doing the podcast?
It was February of last year, so it's been about a year and a half.
Wow, you've been very prolific. You have a lot of episodes out there.
Yeah, well, when we first started, I think we were doing an episode every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And David Smalley, bless him, he's done so much to help me. He's like, look, you gotta go weekly. Like, I love you, I love what you're doing, but you gotta go weekly if you want this thing to be a thing. So we decided to do that. So yeah, I think we're on episode 74.
Mm-hmm.
We'll come out Thursday. I think that's where we're at. So yeah, lots of content. It's weird because it doesn't, you know, I mean, it's at this point, it's just a normal part of my life. So it's, I'm like, wow, are we really at 74 episodes? Yeah.
No, as I look through your archive, I really appreciate and respect the diversity of topics that you have, even, you know, with your focus on the intersection that you described.
Yeah. And thank you. I mean, that's very deliberate. I try really hard not to, because, you know, when there's a book that comes out or there's a piece of news that, you know, that centers on the atheist community, you kind of see there's, you know, the person involved will kind of do the rounds of every atheist podcast. And I don't begrudge any of that. I mean, those conversations are all important, but I try not to be doing the same kinds of conversations that other folks are doing, you know, especially surrounding counter apologetics and, you know, religious arguments and stuff like that. All of that stuff is super important, but there are so many people who do it better than I do. I would rather just focus on what I'm good at, and that's telling stories and giving people a platform to tell their stories. So, you know, when it's something that's super, super relevant, like we had a guy who wrote a book about Scientology on.
Mm-hmm.
And
A to Xenu, is that the one?
Yes.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Chris
title.
Shelton. He's a great guy. And the book is fantastic. But so, you know, I mean, we had him on even though he was doing the rounds, but we skewed the conversation like, so what does Scientology have to say about being queer, about being transgender? And we had that conversation and it was great. So, yeah, I mean, we just try to, you know, have conversations that aren't necessarily being had in other places.
I feel like in your conversations, you bring a lot of warmth and approachability as well as some vulnerability to this.
Yeah, that's kind of the running joke is that every episode of the Gaytheist Manifesto makes somebody cry. You know, what it is for me, honestly, is I figured out pretty early on that people connect with me. And I know this isn't the same for everyone's approach, and I appreciate every different approach because they're all important. But for me personally, I get the most response from people when I'm just brutally honest about things. So, you know, when I'm struggling with a thing, when something bad happens, you know, I just come out there with it. And I always, every single time that I post something that's super vulnerable, super personal that I'm struggling with or about an experience that I had, I can't remember a time I've ever done that where someone didn't say, hey, you know what? Me too. Like, thanks for letting me know that I'm not alone. Or, you know, this is a thing that I've been struggling with too. And you know what? Now that I read this, I think I'm going to go do something about it. So that's kind of what keeps me doing that, because I know that's what helped me a lot of times, people being honest about what they were going through. And me seeing a bit of myself in there, it's like, wow, you know what? I'm not the only one. Like this thing, whatever this thing is that I'm struggling with, this sucks. But like, I'm not the only one, and that's at least something. And then, you know, somebody else saying, well, you know, here's how I navigated that. And I'm like, okay, cool. Like, so this isn't an intractable problem. This is something that I can do something about. And maybe I can turn out okay after all of this. So that's kind of been my strategy, is to just be, I mean, I'm privileged enough to where putting that information out there doesn't really put me at risk. You know, I'm not worried about, you know, losing my job or losing my professional life or losing friends or anything like that. Like, I'm lucky enough to be in a position where I can do that. But I also think that it's really important, not even from an activist standpoint, but just from an interpersonal standpoint. Because the thing that I fear is I don't ever want anyone to be put on pedestals, right? And I feel like, you know, the more honest I am about the flaws that I have, the less likely anyone is to do that. So it's kind of all of those things mashed into one. And, you know, that's in my mind, that's what has impact when you tell stories and you're really honest and, you know, and I mean, sometimes it gets really heavy.
Certainly. looking through your list, there's an episode, I believe it was number 56, where you dove into the concept of safe space and how it does and does not overlap with the idea of free speech. And of course, you know, in modern social media, you know, there's a whole lot of...
Very relevant.
You know, a lot of folks who might be reinterpreting for their own ends here and there. So can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, I think it's really been kind of strawmanned because I think what people perceive or want to perceive, because like you said, I think it's a little bit of an intentional skewing. I don't think it's an innocent misunderstanding. But I mean, what it really is that we're going to set aside a space where all of the stuff that we have to deal with in society, that we can set that outside for a minute and just be who we are. And it really is that simple. It's not about, you know, turning my entire world into a safe space where I can't ever hear anyone who disagrees with me or hear anyone say anything mean about me. I mean, that's silly. There's no one who's serious in my mind that actually wants that. But I also think that it's perfectly reasonable for a group of, say, for example, trans people to say, you know what, we're gonna congregate in this room, and in this room, we're gonna have a safe space where you're not going to be challenged for who you are, and you're not gonna hear bigotry, because you know you get so much of that in the outside world. And I mean, that's the fight that we fight with free speech, right? Because we know speech can and does actually harm people. It's not just about hurt feelings, but it's simply about carving out our own little spaces where we can go and we can be who we are without having to worry about all of the outside stuff for a little bit. It really is that simple. And I don't think that, I mean, if memory serves, the episode's called Safe Space versus Free Speech or something along those lines. And I don't think that those ideas are at odds with one another, or they don't have to be. Anyways, I am as ardent a First Amendment supporter as anyone. I think bigots have the right to speak their mind and be bigots, but I also think that I have the right to inhabit my own spaces sometimes where I can expect that to not happen to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't think those two things are necessarily at odds with one another, as long as I'm not trying to take, you know, a public space and make it that.
Talk to me about the role of compassion in activism.
In my mind, I think compassion is like the number one reason that we do activism, because, I mean, obviously some of it's self-interested. I mean, I do trans activism because I'm trans, but what it really is about is compassion. So I found myself struggling with getting super angry all the time and, you know, saying, you know, lashing out at people, saying mean things. And I noticed, like, am I being effective, right? Like, I own my right to be angry at these things. I don't feel bad for feeling angry, but I have to ask myself, am I actually accomplishing anything in the way that I'm expressing that?
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan. In this episode, Jen Wilson is speaking with Callie Wright of the Gaytheist Manifesto.
So I kind of came up with, and this sounds so Tony Robbins, but I came up with a personal mission statement. And my personal mission statement is simply that I want hurting people to stop hurting. And so for me, compassion is literally what it's all about. Like, the reason that I do activism is because queer and trans people and others too are hurting because of situations in society, because of, you know, segments of society that either don't care about them, outright don't want them to exist, and things like that. So the reason that I want to do what I want to do is because I want things to be better for people like that. And I mean, myself included, I'm relatively privileged for a trans person. I don't have things that bad, but you know, there are definitely still plenty of room for improvement in my life experience. So, I mean, that's the entire reason that I do activism. Compassion is at the base of all of it, because I want to help people and I want people's experiences and lives to be as fulfilling as they can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's important to think about compassion as we apply it to the proverbial other side as well.
Mm-hmm.
In your AHA talk and earlier, you referenced this too. You spoke of a religious identity, you know, being significant in ways similar to an LGBT identity, and that people, you know, it seemed like the suggestion was that for someone to speak out against LGBT rights or something might be a reflection of what they perceive as their identity, something really central to who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you described it, I felt that you were very compassionate toward that view in a way that a lot of people are not able to be yet.
Yeah. And you know, that, and that's fair, because again, like I said, I'm relatively privileged. I've never had someone, you know, I was never kicked out of my house because of religion. I was never, I mean, I did lose a job because of being trans, but I think that had more to do with general bigotry than anything specific to religion, even though we can probably trace it back to that. But again, I think if we're going to change people's minds, we have to at least understand where they're at, right? And that doesn't mean saying that it's okay to be where you're at if you're at a place of bigotry and hatred. It's not okay to be there, but I think we have to try to understand it if we're going to try to remove that view and to bring people out of that view. We have to understand exactly what position we are attacking. Because let's be real, most people are not Steven Anderson, right? Most people are not the, well, I think gay people are pedophiles and they deserve to die. You know, most of the time, it's a lot more subtle than that. And a lot of people don't think that they're being hateful and bigoted. And I think we need to understand where that comes from before we can start to dismantle it. So, you know, I'm not even necessarily sure that compassion might be the word that I would apply towards my attitude there, but it's kind of more pragmatism.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Where, you know, if I'm going to convince you that you're wrong, I have to know exactly what your position is first. And I think that we need to be cognizant of the fact that for many religious people, their religion is their entire identity. And so you can't just say, hey, I believe God exists. Nah, I don't think so. Like, that's, in a lot of ways, that is an attack on someone's identity. And that's not saying we shouldn't do it, because I think, you know, opposing bad ideas is a good thing. I just think we need to understand the context.
Indeed. I'm curious about your take on social media. I mean, it's such an awesome tool with activism and outreach. It creates opportunities for conversations in, you know, safe spaces that we may not have had before. But I was just reviewing an old study by a Harvard law professor. It came out a year or two ago, about the way social media can entrench ideological positions and make it even harder to perceive the other side or to reach across the fence, so to speak. And in your activism, how do you fight that echo chamber effect and the groupthink tendencies?
Yeah, that's a big one. I actually wrote an article for our Pathos blog that says "My Online Friends Are My Real Friends" is the title.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the idea of the article is that social media is a tool, right? You can use a hammer to build a house, or you can use a hammer to kill somebody. The tool isn't the problem. It's how you decide to use it that can be problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you're right. I mean, most of my community that I'm a part of now exists online. I mean, I get to see people at conventions, and sometimes I have the fortunate chance to visit somebody in person. But most of my interaction with the people that I call family now is online. And that's super valuable. I mean, my life would be objectively worse off if I didn't have that. But I mean, you're right. I mean, the whole echo chamber thing, I mean, it's a human tendency, right? We tend to gravitate towards people we agree with and push ourselves away from people we disagree with. And
sure, it makes anthropological sense, if nothing else.
Right, right. And you know, there's the, I forget exactly what the scientific term is for it, but you know, we tend to think of our in-groups as very diverse and our out-groups as very homogenous, right? So the other, they're all the same, right? But my circle of friends, of course we're diverse. We all think differently. We have different opinions. When it really comes down to it, you don't. You know? I mean, there's a very human tendency to surround yourself with people who largely agree with you on things. And I'm not entirely sure that's a bad thing. You know, I mean, if I intentionally surrounded myself with people who don't want me to be equal in society, that would be a very unhealthy thing for me mentally.
Mm-hmm, certainly.
That doesn't mean that you don't engage with those people, but I'm certainly not going to surround myself with those people in social circles, because, you know, there is something to be said for making connections across ideological barriers and humanizing yourself to the opposition. But there's also the fact that, you know, there are people who are vulnerable to those kinds of things, who have, you know, who have been abused and who have legitimate trauma from those things. And I think it's not okay to expect those people to surround themselves with people who don't think that they deserve equal humanity in society. So I think it's kind of incumbent upon people who are relatively privileged, like me, for example, to sort of push into those spaces where it's possible to do so, because, you know, I can handle at least a little bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's definitely a balancing act.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a little bit about the LGBTQ Humanist Alliance. What is the purpose of that group, and how did it get started?
Yeah, so it's actually my involvement's kind of an interesting story, because I was in the process of kind of throwing ideas together to start an LGBTQ atheist secular organization completely on my own. And I, like, you know, a couple ideas for things that we wanted to do. And then I was, you know, I was just looking at the paperwork and all that sort of stuff. And I'm like, there's no way. Like, I would spend all my time on the logistics and none of the time on the activism. So I was like, I'm going to set that aside for a second. And then the American Humanist Association hired Sincere Carrabo as the social justice coordinator. So I reached out to Sincere and I was like, hey, here's some ideas that I had. What do you think? And he's like, well, you know what? We're actually relaunching the LGBTQ arm of the American Humanist Association, and we're calling it the LGBTQ Humanist Alliance. And I was like, that's awesome. Like, I'd love to be involved in that. So I'm one of the co-chairs. There are, I believe, 7 or 8 people on the advisory council. And you know, we're still kind of in the startup phase. There's not a lot to talk about at this point as far as, you know, practical, like, here's boots on the ground things that we're doing. But we, you know, we've partnered up with a couple of organizations. Showing Up for Racial Justice is one. Get Equal is another. And the idea really is to push not only the LGBTQ conversation in the atheist and secular community, but the other way around too. We want to partner with specifically LGBTQ organizations and say, look, we're a significant demographic in this community, and we want to be represented and we want to participate. Because if you look at the polling that's been done, fully half of the LGBTQ community is non-religious. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they call themselves atheists or humanists or secularists or anything like that. But when asked what their religious worldview is, they tick the none box. So I think that's something that's not widely known or reported on, because a lot of times when I say that, people are like, wow, really? So I think it's important for both of those reasons.
Mm-hmm. In terms of boots on the ground activism, you know, even though you're in the early stages here, where do you hope it'll go? What would you like to see happen?
Well, there were a couple of ideas that I had specifically for the organization that I was going to try to start that I would really love to see. And there's just some, you know, logistical hurdles to getting these things done. So I expect that we'll probably move on some or most of it. But one idea that I had was a Google Hangouts support group, because something that I ran into in support groups is, you know, support groups are held at churches, which is not necessarily a huge deal breaker for me, because my exit from religion was very, we'll say, methodical. I didn't struggle a lot with losing religion.
Okay.
It was a very logical process for me. It just stopped making sense, so I stopped believing it. But, I mean, religious trauma syndrome is a thing, right? And there are a lot of people in our community who have that, and they're never going to step foot in a church regardless of the reason. So, and then even aside from that, you know, there's a lot of times there is faith-based conversation in those groups that a lot of people are just not going to be comfortable with. So I think it would be valuable to have a space for LGBTQ secularists and atheists to get together and just know that we're not going to have to deal with that. We're going to be able to be there for each other and speak to each other on that level. So that's something that I would love to see happen. And then the other big one would be thing, and this is, you know, hashtag life goals, but I think it would be awesome to partner with the Secular Therapist Project, from Recovering from Religion, and identify people who are secular therapists who are queer and trans competent, and even push the idea, if you're not, let's do what we can to make you that way. so we can provide, so we can connect people with actual services. Those are kind of the two big ones that that I really would love to see. And then the other things are kind of obvious stuff, like we need to be at conventions and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Visibility is a huge thing.
Right, exactly.
And that's a great seg into one of the questions I had for you. You know, in the humanist community, you know, I followed plenty of the chatter in recent months, and along with the announcement of the new social justice initiatives, there are a whole lot of people who are like, yeah, we need this. And there are plenty as well who really believe that it's divisive to identify groups like a feminist group, the LGBT group, and so forth, who feel that humanism really should just assume that it includes all of those things and that people really understand those issues under the blanket of humanism. What do you think? I mean, how do you respond to people who say the group is not necessarily something humanists need?
Well, first off, I try to resist my urge to be really condescending because it's silly. I mean, it's so silly. Like, okay, so I'm gonna throw out a scenario here. So let's say I go to the doctor because I'm transgender and I want to start hormone replacement therapy. And my doctor says, I don't think being trans is a thing. I'm not going to do this. Get out of my office. If I say to him in response, but I'm a human being, that means literally nothing to him, right? That's not an argument, right? That person is deciding to discriminate against me because of a very specific thing that I am. And refusing to name that doesn't do anything to help the situation. So, and you can apply that to anything. I mean, you can apply it to racial justice. You can apply it to LGBTQ issues. You can apply it to issues faced by people with disabilities, so on and so forth down the list. You know, I can't think of any problem that's ever been solved by not talking about it and by refusing to name the specific problem. You know, police are killing people because they're black. You know, we can't just call this a blanket, oh, well, it's a police brutality thing in general. No, it's extremely disproportionately affecting black people. We have to name that if we're going to solve it. I think what it really comes down to is the fact that people who aren't part of those groups, when you name that, when you say, we're going to focus on feminism, we're going to focus on racial justice, we're going to focus on LGBTQ issues. If you're not a part of that group, then what you feel is your privilege under attack is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of goes back to that old, you know, when you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. And I think that's really what it is. People who aren't members of those groups, who aren't people of color, who aren't LGBTQ, who aren't women, they don't recognize the specific problems, or don't want to recognize the specific problems that those people face because of those specific facets of their identity. You know, if, for example, you know, if we could look at police brutality and we could say that the percentages of people killed by the police map exactly with the percentages of demographics in the population, then we can say, yeah, this is a general police brutality problem and we have to address it as such. No, there are specific problems that are happening to people because of very specific facets of their identity. And if we're going to fix those problems, we have to be specific.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is a very, very logical thing in my mind.
Absolutely agreed. And it's nasty out there. You referred to the items in recent news about the police brutality, so-called. And yeah, it's really been an ugly week.
Yeah, it really has.
But how do you deal with fatigue? With all this stuff coming at you, and you know, especially in the LGBT community, how do you keep going when it just wears you down?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of things. I'm a person who, you know, I'm in activism because I like helping. You know, it's something that I think is important, but it's also something that I get personal fulfillment from. So when things like, for example, when Orlando happened, you know, my immediate thing is, what can I do to help people start to heal? You know, what can I do to help? And that is self-care for me. Feeling like I'm helping, feeling like I'm doing something about it, that helps me. So I'm fortunate in that way that usually stepping up and doing activism is something that actually makes me feel better. Because, you know, there's nothing that makes me feel better more than getting a message from someone saying, you know, I was really struggling with this, and I'm feeling a little more okay with it now after I listened to your episode, or I, you know, read something that you posted on Facebook. So, I mean, just feeling like I'm helping is a big thing for me. And then also, like, you just have to know when it's time to turn the computer off and watch Netflix for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question at a Q&A that I did at Georgia Southern University, and they were talking about that, how you feel guilty when you feel like you have to step back because I mean, these issues are vital, right? It's not like we're fighting for some, you know, academic idea that exists in a vacuum, right? And in many ways, we are fighting for our livelihoods and our lives. So it can feel really, really bad to step back from that and, you know, kind of lay out your burden on other people who haven't done so. So it's an understandable thing to feel guilt over that. But my response is that at the end of the day, we're fighting for ourselves, or we're fighting for people in these specific groups that have these issues. And we're doing that because these people are precious. We value these lives. And so when you step back to take care of yourself, you're taking care of something precious. And that is activism. Self-care is activism in my mind. In a world that largely either wants to ignore me or pretend I don't exist or wishes I didn't exist, I really think that taking care of myself and making myself okay and living happily and living a fulfilled life in the face of that, I mean, that is activism to me.
That's awesome. And it reminds me of one of your earlier episodes. I think it was number 41. You spoke of a tradition that you call Friendsgiving, where you, in a way, reclaim Thanksgiving with your chosen family and your community. Can you speak a little bit about that? I think it just ties in awesomely with self-care.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan. In this episode, Jen Wilson is speaking with Callie Wright of the Gay Theist Manifesto.
Yeah, so what we did was we did an episode on Thanksgiving night because lots of folks, I mean, even just in the atheist community, who aren't in contact with their families anymore simply because they've left religion. And then I think it's pretty obvious that there are lots of LGBTQ people who don't have contact with their families anymore. And so, you know, they see all of these people like, oh, I'm spending time with my family. It's going to be a great night. Yay, happy. And I mean, that's great. But it can feel really lonely when you don't have that. And it's a very painful reminder of what you've had to lose to be honest about who you are. So we decided that we were going to do a live episode Thanksgiving night to give folks a place to come and hang out for 2 hours. And you know, we had a couple of guests on, and we had, you know, conversation, and we had we did a live episode because we do live episodes from time to time, and we had people call in via Skype. And you know, there was no specific topic. It wasn't about activism or education or anything like that. It was kind of just more about just hanging out and talking and being a family. So it was, you know, it was kind of a way to provide that for people. And I'm pretty sure we're going to do it again this year because, you know, I had a lot of feedback from people saying, you know, I haven't been with my family for Thanksgiving in 2 years, and I feel like I have that again tonight. So, you know, it seemed like it really meant something to folks. And I mean, it meant something to me too. I'm fortunate enough that my immediate family is very supportive of me. My extended family, not so much, but it's painful, but it's not devastating because I still have my mom and my brother and my sister. So, I mean, you know, I went and did things with them, but I mean, it was cool for me too, just to be able to spend time with those folks in the context of, you know, okay, we're not doing activism tonight. We're just hanging out. We're being people. We're talking. We're having fun, and we're enjoying each other's company. So that's something I think every year that I'm able, I'm going to do that.
That's awesome. You know, people poo-poo the internet for being what it is, and it can enable such beautiful things. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it really is. You know, there are so many people that I hear like, you know, oh, I found this community online and I literally decided not to commit suicide because I know that there are people out here like me. And, you know, it doesn't solve all my problems. It doesn't make everything okay, but I have a community to lean on now. And that means that I can, you know, make it through.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And I just like, how can anybody criticize that? Come
Absolutely.
On.
Gosh. Well, one thing I've learned about you, Callie, is that you are, you know, kind of in passing, maybe a wee bit of a Star Trek fan.
Yes, yeah, a little bit. It's you know, it's a thing I watch from time to time.
Here and there, yeah. And, you know, obviously Star Trek has plenty of humanist values that we love, and it's very popular in the AHA community.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, at the AHA conference, I hope you got to meet John DeLancey.
Oh, I did. I did. I got a picture, and I almost died.
Oh. He was such a treat. But I'm very curious. I will admit, the new Star Trek movies are really not every hardcore fan's cup of tea, and that is completely understandable. But recently there's been a bit of a controversy when it was announced that Sulu, in the modern retelling of the story, Sulu is actually a gay character. He has a husband and a daughter. And, you know, George Takei was not a fan of that decision for reasons that he enunciated very well. And I haven't actually read it yet. I saw a headline go by just this morning that Simon Pegg had a theory that might make it okay in terms of alternate realities and so forth. I've just got to know what you think of all that.
Frankly, I think it's way past time for there to be an openly LGBT character on Star Trek. I'm really hoping the new series that they're developing has one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the producer of the show actually said, like, we're going to continue exploring, quote, progressive ideals. And, you know, I hope that was code for, you know, we're going to have a gay character. We're going to have, God, if they had a trans character, I would die.
That'd be pretty awesome.
But if, so I read, a friend of mine sent me the article where they said, you know, Sulu is going to be gay in the new movie. And I cried. I mean, I cried. I've been waiting for that for so long because there are specific episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation that really meant a lot to me as a kid because they explore themes surrounding gender and sexuality. Even, you know, they don't do so overtly, but I think anyone who can look even the tiniest little bit past the surface will see exactly what they're trying to do. And I mean, those things meant everything to me as a kid. And it's, I mean, it's way past time. And I mean, I cried. I was so happy. And then I found out that George Takei wasn't happy about it. And I'm like, Uncle George, come on.
Uncle George, I love it.
And, you know, in fairness, I understand where he's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Because in his mind, the idea is that, you know, if Sulu is shown to be gay now, that would mean that he was closeted the entire rest of the series. Because it's not mentioned ever anywhere else that he's gay.
Mm-hmm.
And the 23rd century is a place where people shouldn't have to be closeted, right? So there's just, you know, kind of speaking on a nerd level, there's some incontinuity there. And you know, I get that. But again, I just think it's so, so far past time. And Simon Pegg's explanation, honestly, I mean, it makes sense. So the idea basically is that it's not as if So there's the Kelvin timeline, which is the timeline in the new movies. And then there's the traditional timeline. And it's not as if the timeline simply diverged in the first movie. In my understanding, one of the things in time travel is that when you travel across time, you actually travel into different realities. So in these two separate realities, it's entirely possible for other things to be different too. Sulu could be straight in the universe that we all know and could very easily be gay in the Kelvin timeline, in the Kelvin universe. So, I mean, I think that makes perfect sense to me. And, you know, introducing another character as gay, another thing that Simon Pegg said that I agree with, introducing another character would mean that you would have to go out of your way deliberately to show that they were gay.
Mm-hmm.
and it would detract from the story, and it would be kind of cheap and kind of a tokenizing thing. And I actually, I mean, I agree with that. So on the whole, like, I'm really bummed that George Takei isn't happy about it, but I'm absolutely ecstatic. I think it's way past time. You know, Star Trek was the first place that I was ever, that it was ever implied that it was okay for me to be who I am, and that, you know, and that I deserve to be treated like anyone else. And so, yeah, I'm really, really happy about it, even though I'm a little bummed that that George Takei isn't.
Awesome. I'm, there's plenty of, you know, Kirk has kind of seemed to be a pansexual character. You know, I know people who argue for and against that. And it's really cool that they're finally coming out
and absolutely,
you know, stating that just as a simple fact of this character's life, here it is. And it's really neat.
Well, yeah. And my understanding is that they show it in the movie in kind of an offhand way. It's just like, oh, here's Sulu with his family. It's not like, hey, everybody, look, he's gay.
Dun, dun, dun.
You know, it's a very like, oh, we're going to show Sulu with his family. And his family happens to be his husband and their daughter. Like, and I mean, I think that's awesome. It's just, you know, I mean, there's value in pointing that out and as that being part of the story, because we're, I mean, we're not at the point where being gay is normalized or being trans is normalized. But I mean, I think there's also value in that being just simply a facet of a character, you know, of who they are. It's not something like they have to exist solely because they're the gay character. I think there's a lot of value in that too. So yeah, so I'm really happy about it.
Awesome. Well, cool. In closing, how can we follow what you're doing with the LGBTQ Humanist Alliance?
So you can just search on Facebook. You can search LGBTQ Humanist Alliance. There's a page you can like. All of the updates are there.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Cool stuff. And I know that you are very active. In addition to your podcast, you also write and publish articles in a few places. How can we find you?
Yes. So as far as the podcast goes, we're on Spreaker. We're on iTunes. Pretty much any place you can find podcasts, you can find the Gay Theist Manifesto. The Gay Theist Manifesto is also a blog on Pathios. So it's pathios.com/blogs/the Gay Theist Manifesto. And you can find Ari, my co-host, and I writing on various different topics related specifically to LGBTQ and atheist activism and kind of more general social justice-y things. Yeah, and sometimes I'm lucky enough to write a guest article for The Humanist, which is cool too.
Very cool. Well, I've had a blast talking to you, Callie. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Awesome. Look forward to seeing what you do next.
Thank you.
Earlier in this episode, you heard Jen and Callie talk about what Callie accomplishes by being vulnerable in public. You also heard them talk about AHAcon in Chicago, where Callie spoke this year. The following is excerpted from Callie's talk, demonstrating her willingness to be open about the challenges she faces. The entire talk is available on the American Humanist Association's YouTube channel.
This is Jim Obergefell and his husband, John Arthur. They'd been together for 20 years because that whole being gay thing's just a phase, of course. In 2011, John was diagnosed with ALS, which is a terrible degenerative disease, I'm sure we all know. In 2013, the Supreme Court struck down a key provision of the Defense of Marriage Act, conferring legal benefits to married same-sex couples in the states where it was legal. So Jim and John decided at that point they did want to get married because they had the same legal rights as everyone else then. But Ohio, it wasn't legal there. Problem was, John was almost on his deathbed at this point. So they had to get a Facebook campaign to raise $13,000 for a medical transport plane to get them to Maryland. Once the plane landed, they were married on the tarmac. And because Ohio is, in fact, the worst state ever, that's not where Jim and John's journey ended. Eventually, they recognized that because their marriage wasn't legal in Ohio, that Jim's name wouldn't be on John's death certificate as the surviving spouse, and that their family burial plot wouldn't allow them to be buried together because their marriage wasn't legally recognized. That's when they filed suit. And of course, there are lots of details in between, but that's the case that made it to the Supreme Court that decided marriage equality for all of us. The problem is that John Arthur didn't live to see it. John Arthur died 3 months after they were married. So Jim had to celebrate this victory without his husband at his side. So obviously this was a great victory, but I think it's important to remember what the fight cost. Second story, you heard me earlier on mention Leela Alcorn, a 17-year-old trans girl who committed suicide after being rejected by her parents and sent to conversion therapy. I've decided I've had enough. I'm never going to transition successfully, even when I move out. I'm never going to be happy with the way I look or sound. I'm never going to have enough friends to satisfy me. I'm never going to have enough love to satisfy me. I'm never going to find a man who loves me. I'm never going to be happy. Either I live the rest of my life as a lonely man who wishes he were a woman, or I live my life as a lonelier woman who hates herself. There is no winning. There's no way out. So there was a worldwide outpouring of love and support for Leela and for the trans community. There were vigils all over the country. And pardon the pun, but this was hailed as sort of a come to Jesus moment in society for the trans community, right? Because the line that we hear so often is that this is a terrible tragedy, but people are finally talking and that's a positive. The problem here is that a 17-year-old had to commit suicide before that happened. The thing is, many trans kids feel like their lives are worth nothing because no one cares about them. They see a note like Leela's where they admonished us to fix society, and they see the hashtags, and they see the memes, and they see the art, and the idea that they get is that they will find the love they crave if they kill themselves. Now, reading that note wrecked me for a couple of reasons. Obviously, a 17-year-old committing suicide is sufficiently tragic, regardless of the circumstances, but religion's role and the similarities between her situation and mine really punched me in the stomach. In her note, she talked about not being able to be satisfied with the life she would live after transition, and that's what kept me in the closet for 28 years. I remember driving home from work one night when things were particularly bad and thinking to myself, you know what, if I crashed my car, maybe it would look like it was an accident. Now, lest you think I simply came here to depress you, there is another side to this. Hearing lots of people talk about their experiences as queer or trans people can sometimes make it sound like it's a miserable experience, and I'm not going to lie, sometimes it is. Experiencing hate is awful. But if I want someone to take a single thing away from my story, from any success that I have, from any difference that I make in this world, is that I'm not exceptional. Despite the challenges that we face from ourselves and from the world, if we have support from our friends, our family, and our communities, and access to competent medical care, we can and do thrive. And anytime someone compliments me for being so open with my story and so honest about the things that I've struggled with, I remind them that there's no way in hell any of this would be happening without my support system. Because the support system is vital for anyone, because we're human beings and we're social creatures. But for vulnerable people, it's even more so. Coming out wasn't an act of courage, it was an act of desperation. And the support that I received allowed me to step out just a little further. And every time I stepped out further, I was met with more love and more affirmation and more support. And I am the person I am today because of that love and support. So coming out was the single most terrifying thing that I've ever done in my life. It's a rare occasion that you have to expose your deepest secret to the public, but if I was going to deal with who I was, I didn't have a choice. But living my life as the person I've always known myself to be has been the most liberating and joyous experience of my life, despite the struggles. I've never been happier in my life. I've never been more comfortable in my own skin. I've never felt better about the way I relate to people, and I've never felt more free. The problem with religion is not that its ideas are incorrect. There isn't a person in this room who hasn't been spectacularly wrong about something at some point, right? The problem with religion is dogma. And the dogma surrounding, the dogma of one man, one woman, or born a man, always a man, born a woman, always a woman, these ideas don't exist because they're good ideas. They don't exist because they're likely to make anyone's life any better or any happier. These dogmas exist specifically because a religion said so. And speaking out against those dogmas is very directly to speak out against Bronze Age philosophy. I believe with all of my heart that this community is the place to be for equality. I believe that we can and should be leading the fight for equality. As atheists and secularists, we know that religion continues to be an impediment to almost all human progress. And it's by fighting the notion that faith is a good way to know things that we really allow ourselves to see our fellow human beings for who they actually are. And I can't say enough good things about the way I've not only seen us embrace this change, but the way I've seen us take the lead and be part of this change. So, in closing, we've had a lot to celebrate between marriage equality, trans visibility. There's been lots of good stuff happening. But we have a very, very long way to go. We can and should be leading on these issues. I've seen and felt and heard the love, the support, the affirmation that this community is capable of. So let's keep doing that.
As always, we value your feedback on the show. Have a comment or question for today's guests? Have a suggestion for a guest you'd like us to interview? Email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thank you again for listening to The Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association.